بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. This is a movement going on, but I think I shall start. I don't want to keep you waiting. This is the last of three lectures which I'm giving on metaphysics. And today I shall discuss the significance of metaphysics for religion, fields of knowledge and art, different aspects of human activity, and which at least pertain to human activity. Some of these issues I touched upon last time or yesterday, but I have to come to again. The first two lectures really dealt with principles and how to gain access to them. And today's lecture will concentrate mostly on how to apply them. I shall leave some time for questions and answers. There are already some questions that have been sent to me, and I shall try to read those, and then other questions, they will raise their hands at the end of my lecture. What I tried to impress upon you during the two lectures yesterday was that there's a body of knowledge which is called metaphysics, which is a supreme science, a sacred science, scientia sacra, dealing with the ultimate principle, with the us, with the, that is, with God, with the one, the source of all things. And this science is a science, it's a knowledge. The word science has become very limited in the English language, more so than in French, and it pertains to only one very limited form of knowledge called science, the quantitative study of the realm of nature and mathematics. But by science, I mean the original word that is knowledge, organized knowledge. So metaphysics is a body of knowledge concerning that, the principle of all reality, a knowledge which is only attainable if we are attuned to it. That is, there has to be a relationship between the knower and the known. There has to be a correspondence between the knower and the known, without which the knower cannot know the known. And therefore, to know metaphysics, we have to do something with ourselves. There has to be something within us to enable us to understand this body of knowledge. In the same way that if we had no eyes, we could not see the external world physically. If we had no ears, we could not hear sounds. There has to be an instrument of knowledge which is able to know this knowledge. And this is traditionally symbolized by the heart. It's more than a symbol, because the physical heart, which is the left of our chest, there's a spiritual heart, which is the center of our breast, which is not sensed by most of us, but sometimes it manifests itself even physically as physiological reverberations into which I will not go. In that heart center that is able to know, and the Quran always associates knowledge with the heart, not with the head. Always. Throughout the Quran, it's the heart that knows, not the head. It's not mental knowledge, it's that principial knowledge was associated with the heart. And that's where the intellect, as I defined it yesterday, is located, where the eye that is able to see the divine reality is closed for most of us, with the possibility of its opening up for all of us if we dedicate ourselves to it, the opening of the ayn al-ghalb, the eye of the heart. Now, this body of metaphysical knowledge, I hope we have some understanding of. And today I want to discuss why it is so important for everyday human life, emphasizing again what I said yesterday, that it's not necessary for everyone in a human society to have this kind of knowledge. But it's necessary for some to do so. I give a physical example. It's not necessary for everyone in this class to be an electrical engineer. But if there were to be no electrical engineer in Toronto, this lamp would not work. The society as a whole needs a number of people who know what to do with electricity so the lamp works. And a society as a whole, a healthy Islamic society, always need the few who know. And Islam was able to preserve through 14 centuries of its history always a body of men and sometimes women who knew in the real sense, who knew the principles, who knew this supreme knowledge. And they were able to apply it as the circumstances required it. And we are the first generation, perhaps, the whole service long, where this knowledge has become eclipsed so much. Not totally, thank God, not totally, but eclipsed so much that many of our people, especially younger generation, are totally unaware of it. And there's a whole movement within the Islamic world to try to, in fact, forget about it. As if God has sent his prophet just for externalities and not to bring us back to him, which is his origin and source and the raison d'être, that is the reason for the existence of religion itself. So let's turn again to the significance of metaphysics, first of all, for religion. I mentioned this yesterday, but now I want to give some concrete examples. Let me start with an example which has been dealt with thousands of times in Western literature, which caused millions of people to leave the Christian church, and that is why, if God is good, there is evil in the world. I'm sure all of you have faced this question. Why is there evil? Question of evil. It's been dealt with in Western literature, all the way from philosophical texts to Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment, to literature. It's one of the favorite themes of the West. And one of the great paradoxes of human history is that I do not know of any Muslims who have left Islam because they could not answer this question. But I've known hundreds of Westerners who were Christians who left Christianity because they could not answer this question. This itself is a great paradox. I mean, it's a really strange thing. Why is this so? Why is this not such an issue in Hindu India? In Buddhist Burma? Why doesn't anyone leave Buddhism because there's so much poverty in Myanmar? This is a very, very profound and important question. Because the answer to this question cannot come from the external teachings of religion, which teach you to be good, but there's also evil in the world. But why is there evil in the world? If God is good, why is there evil in the world? Thousands of theologians in every religion have addressed themselves to this issue. But a religion which does not have an answer for such a cardinal and central subject is going to lose some of its followers. They're going to seek elsewhere. And the best example of it is the open book of the history of Christianity in the West before you. Anyone who studied the history of Christianity, why there are so many of the intelligent Frenchmen in the 18th century left the Catholic Church, was over this issue. And they've been written about over and over again. Now, metaphysics has an answer for this. The answer will not be understood by everyone, but it's there for those for whom it's meant, and they will understand it, and having understood it will prevent this drainage or this loss of blood of the religion when there's no one who understands able to provide an answer for this. I can give you the answer very quickly, 2 minutes. It might take the rest of your lifetime to understand what I just said, about what I said, but I will give you a few minutes. Only God is good. Starting with the thesis. Only God is good. As we said yesterday, God is absolute, infinite, and perfect goodness. Only God is good. Being infinite, he must contain within himself all possibilities. Otherwise, we're not the infinite. Including the possibility of negating himself. And that possibility is the world. To say world or creation means separation from the good. And it's that separation which is the source of all evil, what we call evil. Very simple, finished. But if you don't understand what I'm saying, to understand it, you have to understand levels of reality, levels of being. That which itself has been lost in the modern world. Even faithful people, there's God and there's us. That fact that levels of being has been lost, which was foundational to Islamic metaphysics, to Christian metaphysics everywhere, and it got lost in the 18th century in Europe and was converted to a theory of evolution. That is the ladder, vertical ladder of reality, which went from the lowest to the highest reality, reaching God finally, was horizontalized. instead of progressing vertically towards the angelic world, you come from the apes and will evolve through building a few more Torontos, which are beginning to look so ugly, turned into Superman and have extraordinary people. You know, this, I'm of course, making a joke, a parody of evolution, but because one of the greatest absurdities foisted upon the human race, human species in the history of humanity. But it's a very common thing. But this is a kind of secularization and horizontalization of the vertical hierarchy, which was foundational to all metaphysics. And the reason why the Islam, for example, did not have the crisis that Christianity faced in the 19th century when Darwinism came was because the vertical hierarchy had not disappeared. Darwinism hardly made a ripple in the Islamic world or in the Hindu world. It's quite interesting, especially in the Islamic world. It was not even a major intellectual issue. So a few people talked about it on the side. That was it. The reason is that the vertical hierarchy was still very much alive. And this vertical hierarchy, by hierarchy, would be always a separation from that which is the source of the hierarchy. And I repeat, said only God is good, but God has to create because it's infinite. And infinity implies the negation even of, of its own possibility, which is the world. And this elongation, this separation, is what appears to us as evil. Dante said so beautifully that evil and hell are separation from God. Of course, in the Quran, the pain of hell is even greater because we see God and we're still separated. It's much worse than if you do not see him and don't think about it. But anyway, this is the origin of evil. Now, the simple three statements that I made, you're not going to find in a book of fiqh of Islamic law. You will not even find it in a book of theology. This comes from pure metaphysics, which I try to simplify for you in a few sentences. Now, a religion which does not have an answer to this is going to lose its most intelligent people. Or they will become simply blind followers without thinking. Which in fact is against the Quranic advice for us to think all the time. Tafakkaru, tafakkahu, all of these verbs are used in Arabic, ta'aqqalu, different forms of thinking are encouraged by the Quran. So we certainly should not be those who stop thinking and say, well, I accept this Talmud as a servant of God, I won't think about it. That's against the Quran itself. So this was just one example among many, many examples. And they're fundamental, really, they're fundamental. The question of, for example, the nature of our soul, where do we come from? Any profound person will ask that. The Quran asks very simply, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raja'un, which we usually recite when someone is dead. Where do we come from? God, and unto whom is our return. But when you really think about it, it's metaphysics that answers this deep meaning of this verse that everybody recites all the time. We come from God. Now, we come from God, which means that means all that God can create from nothing. That nothing itself is our form that is contained in the divine intellect, the divine reality. And so we have a kind of pre-existent reality in God. Otherwise, we could not have said before the creation of Adam, Bala to God. When the Quran says, Alastu barabbakum qalu bala, this is before Adam was created. So we had a pre-Adamic reality in God, or with God. And to understand this, you have to understand metaphysics. Because it's beyond time, beyond our conception of history, belonging to another reality. That's what metaphysics is. And then where are we going? Well, we read the ordinary eschatologies written in the Quran or the Bible or other religions. The Quran is very, very strong in talking about eschatology from the beginning to end, from Surah Al-Baqarah to practically the end of the Quran. It comes back to these themes of heaven and hell, felicitous states and states of pain, and so forth and so on. But things are much more complicated than that. And there are many verses of the Quran, for example, the darijat of paradise and of hell, the grades and degrees. What do they imply? And it's not just a question of morality, it's a question of the states of being. The question of how and why does the divine mercy encompasses all things. Rahmatahu wasa kulli shay. How is it that, therefore, it can in fact overcome God's own teachings about punishment and reward? How does divine mercy work? These things are not elements of religion. That ordinary, either theological or legal aspects of the religion can respond to. It's what the inner aspect of the religion has always responded to. And therefore, if you take that inner aspect out, a religion crumbles. It no longer has an answer for some of the most important questions which human beings ask. Even something as simple as this, why should I be good? You know, almost all of us face this in daily life. We see good people suffering and evil people doing very well with a very comfortable life, and we wonder what's going on. Where's God's justice? If either we cling to our faith and say, well, I won't ask this question, only God knows, God is Hakim, the usual answer that we give, or we try to delve more deeply into it, and if we delve more deeply into it, we come back to the longer chain of cause and effect, what the Hindus call karma, and has entered into the English language. We have it in our own language. Cause and effect. Every cause has its effect. Every good thing we do has its positive effect. Every evil thing that we do has a negative effect. That means we must have had a pre-terrestrial existence. We've come into this world not as a blank page, but already with certain nature, a certain, we might say, book written about our amal, our actions. That's not mentioned in ordinary religion. But why is it that some children are so intelligent, some children are not? Why is it that some children can swim so well, others will sink, they can't swim? Why is it some are good athletes, others are not? Why some learn languages well, others do not? Where is God's justice? If you cannot answer these questions, the foundation of faith is gradually shaken. And therefore, metaphysics is not just an exercise in luxury of thinking. It's foundational for the survival of a religion. I repeat that. I could go on with many, many other examples. I do not want to bother you. A complicated example, the question of the origin of the world. Why is there a world? And why this world? Are these very profound issues, a collectivity, human collectivity, has to have the answer to. Not everyone in that collectivity. I mentioned this for a hundredth time. We don't need in Toronto everyone to be a good mathematician. But we do need a few mathematicians. Otherwise things will collapse. Like the example I gave for electrical engineer. Maybe there's not one single electrical engineer in this room. But if there were none in Toronto, as I said, we'd be in the dark right now in this room. So the collectivity also needs human beings who have answers to such questions. And the grandeur of a religion like Islam is quite amazing, is that it was able to create a system whereby such answers of the deepest kind could percolate through the whole of society. So we have in Islamic texts, all the way from abstract, very difficult metaphysical texts, which takes years to understand. I've studied myself years and years with traditional masters in Iran, texts of both metaphysics and Islamic philosophy. Sometimes it would take 3 weeks to just study one page, not because of the Arabic text, but because of what it meant, the depth of the meaning. It was not available to everyone, it was not for everyone, but it was there for those who needed it. And it came in those very difficult texts from one side. And then simpler explanations, a bit simpler, when the great teachers used to teach, like I explained, the Bazaar of Tehran, great master like Allama Ghazvini, who was one of the greatest metaphysicians of his day. Even some of the beach sellers in the bazaar would come and sit in the class. Because Islamic education was open to everyone. You didn't have to pay tuition and sign up and registration and all these modern things. Education was always free for everyone. Just went in and sat down in a madrasa, mosque, like Al-Azhar. In Al-Azhar, you could do that a few years ago. Now they've made regulations that don't let you in anymore. So we'd sit down, and he would get something out of it. So a kind of gradation, I said percolating, like coffee percolates until the whole liquid becomes coffee. These very exalted teachings would gradually percolate into ordinary conscience of people who were not that educated. And in this field, Islamic literature played a very important role, especially poetry. I can hardly overemphasize this. It's something the like of which we do not have in the West. The only country which could be an exception is Italy, where some people know a few verses of Dante's Divine Comedy, but not everyone. Even that Italian is not very rare to them. I'm a Persian myself. In Iran, there is no servant, no sweeper of the street who does not know a few poems of Hafiz and Rumi. It is the most exalted metaphysics, but explained in simple language. I always give this example, which is telling for you. I will repeat it for you. I've studied in the best universities in the West. I'm a Harvard graduate. I've taught at Harvard. I've taught in Europe. I've studied with the greatest masters in the East, you can imagine. And one day, I was outside of Lahore. It was the evening. I went to visit the tomb of Mian Mir, the great Qadiri saint of the 17th century. Beautiful tomb. At that time, in the middle of the fields, now the slums of Lahore have encompassed it, unfortunately. This is 50 years ago. I was a young man. And I came out, it was about 8 o'clock at night. And there was one tanga. There's these carriages that had in Pakistan at that time, with one horse. And the driver, his whole clothing was worth about $1.50. Just a piece of dirty cloth wound up around him. A very, very poor man. And he said to order to be, of course, he said, Salaam alaikum, Salaam alaikum, Salaam. And he said to order, where are you going? I'm not Pakistani, my mother tongue is Persian, I don't know Arabic, I know very little Urdu, but I understood enough. But most of Urdu is Persian, really, with some Hindi or Sanskritic verbs. I said in Persian to him, I'm going to Gulbarg in Lahore. He said, get in. It took us 45 minutes to get there. During the 45 minutes, incessantly he recited classical Persian poetry of Hafez and Rumi. He taught me more metaphysics in those 45 minutes than in any classroom at Harvard or Oxford that I've taken courses with the greatest teachers in the West on metaphysics, Wolfson, Gilson, people like that. That the tanga driver was still a product of traditional Islamic civilization. That is something through poetry, especially, would percolate into the common culture and through other forms of art to which I will turn in a moment, including music. Music, the plastic arts, architecture, and so forth, about which I will speak in a minute. So the Islam produced a means whereby this very exalted science, which in itself is only for the few, could in a sense permeate through the whole structure of society and became a protective code in the mind for the rebellion of the mind against the divine, against God. Why is it so many of you people who are older here have trouble with your teenage children about religion? They're rebelling. And you don't have the ways of, in a sense, overcoming their doubts. If you were living in all the days in the Islamic world, there were always means available. And of course, those have now been lost within the very community and within the Islamic world itself. So much is being lost very, very rapidly. Anyway, let me conclude this by saying that there's no way for religion to survive without having certain inner questions which have a religious order answered. Once they're not answered, what happened in the West to religion will happen to other religions, including Islam. There's no exception. Any human being who's honest with himself, and in order to be honest with God, you have to be honest with yourself. If you fall into a state of doubt, you have to be honest enough to face it. The supreme example of this is Ghazali, a great Shafi'i alim who at the peak of his career fell into doubt. But he left everything. He left his family, his position, his money, disappeared for 10 years to regain certitude. A young man who's honest with himself or herself, a young woman, once they fall into a state of doubt, either they were hided and then they become hypocrites for themselves because they fear their parents, or they're going to stop becoming serious interest in religion, becoming lukewarm, looking elsewhere. I've had tens and tens and tens and tens of students from the Islamic background, I've been professor for 30 years now in America, who you know, have left the field of religion because they had certain questions which that ambience, the imam and the mosque, or the parents could not satisfy. So the first role of metaphysics is the preservation of religion. And that the Muslims always remember the history of Western Christianity from the 15th century, 16th century to today. Never forget that as we sit here today, only 9% of people in France, which was called the bride of the Christian church, go to church on Sunday. And over 40% of French people are atheists, declared atheists. 40%. And another 20% are agnostics. That in England, where the church is officially also the state, where Queen Elizabeth is the head of the Anglican church, only 5% of Englishmen go to church, the Anglican church, on Sundays. England, then Britain, which has a population of 50 million, only 2 million Muslims. The number of Muslims who go to mosque on Friday is more than the number of Christians who go to church. Can you imagine these statistics? I mean, think about this. We're here to think. This is supposed to be about knowledge. Just don't let it glide by you. Why has this phenomenon taken place? I'm trying to give you some of the deeper reasons. I don't have time to analyze step by step what happened from the 14th century and the nominalist movement, or having the Renaissance, why metaphysics was eclipsed in the West. I don't have time to do that. It's in my writing, the writing of Guénon, other people, you're going to go and read about. But the net result is what you see before your eyes. And this should be the best proof of the significance of metaphysics, not as a luxury, but as a necessity. Like the heart, which you never see. You see my hands, you see my eyes, you see my ear, you don't see my heart. But nevertheless, it's the most important part of the body which governs everything else. And the metaphysics is like the inner knowledge, whatever you like to call it. I'll try to explain why we call it metaphysics. Now, I want to devote the rest of the time that I allowed to be, because I want to give you some time to ask some questions also. It's the last meeting I'm having with you. How this supreme science, which I've tried to reiterate, applies to other fields other than religion. As I said yesterday, one of the great tragedies that occurred in the West was a mistake that was made in the time of Aristotle of making metaphysics a part of philosophy. Whereas in fact it's the other way around. Philosophy is an application of metaphysics to certain domains of knowledge, which we call philosophical knowledge. So the priority comes not with philosophy but with metaphysics. And in every classical work, for example, Islamic philosophy, it always begins with metaphysics. Sometimes, like in Ibn Sina's Kitab al-Shifa, the Book of Healing, of course, you begin with logic, but that's for other reasons. But the understanding of things begins with Ilahiyat. And certainly later Islamic philosophy, which was much more metaphysical, always begins with metaphysics, like Suhrawardi, for example, the great book, the Hikmatul Ishraq, the Theosophy of the Orient of Light, begins very, very beginning with the divine reality and ends actually with other matters. Anyway, the first important application is that in Islam always, where philosophy survived, it was always actually backed by and was a branch of metaphysics, you must. It was applied metaphysics to the realm of philosophy and including logic. Including logic. Today, logic is pitted against metaphysics. Famous Western philosophers like Bertrand Russell have written books on logic against metaphysics or articles. But ask yourself the question, if you say 2 and 2 is 4, so logically 4 and 4 is 8, where does that certitude come from? Why are you so certain? So this is logical. Don't forget that the word logic is related to the word logos, which means both knowledge and the word of God. It's like kalimatullah and almullah in Greek. And we have it in Arabic. Lagus entered into Arabic, but it's very rare word. It's only experts know about it, so I'm not going to use it. But the word that we are using English now, logia, we have it in all the forms of knowledge, geology, theology, psychology, and we have it in logic. And it has to do with the Word of God. It's very interesting how this was translated into Arabic. The word logic was translated, that is the science of logic, was translated into Arabic as mantiq. And originally was mantuq, bab al-maf'ul, from the root nutq, which means speech, the word. It's preserving the original Greek meaning of logos. So we say mantar. When we don't ask what does that have to do with my speaking? It has to do with my speaking. It has to do with nutq in the original metaphysical sense of the term. The divine word. The word of God. And so even logic, which we take to be opposed to religion and mystery and mysticism and metaphysics and so forth and so on, I pose the question, where does this certitude of logic come from? And the answer is we found in metaphysics. The certitude is the reflection of the intellect upon the mental plane. It's the certitude that comes from the reflection of the intellect. It's the knowledge already contained in the intellect. The reflection upon the mental plane. And we don't even question. You immediately understand it. As long as we have a little bit of sense of logic, we understand. The child begins to understand logic very quickly as this intellect becomes more and more reflected on the mental plane. And that's why when the reflection is not there, the human beings are not logical. Because logic is not a faculty of the mind. It's a reflection of another faculty that's above the mind. And that reflection is not always the same in all people. Some people are very logical, some people somewhat logical, some people not logical at all, and so forth and so on. And it's very interesting when we have a fight, both men and women, especially when women become very emotional. Of course, they don't have to be logical. The very necessity goes by. Those of you who, like me, have had experience of this for many decades, you will bear me up. You're all too young for that. What happens is that like in water that is blown by the wind, the reflection is lost. As soon as the water becomes calmed down, the reflection comes back. We experience that every day in our own lives. So even logic, to understand why there is logic, why is it that it works? Why is it, does it correspond to that external reality? It's a great mystery if you don't have a metaphysical knowledge. Why is it that something that is in my mind I conceive, I can build a machine with, the result of which has an effect upon nature, just as I conceived it? What is the link between the logic in my mind and that thing working out there in that factory out there and the producing what it's producing? All of these are related essentially to applied metaphysics. That's why we don't ask these questions today. Probably these things I posed for you, many of you have not even thought about it. Why is that in my mind if my bicycle loses its air? I know that I have to find a place and pump it so it have air again. This thought in my mind, how is it related to the bicycle? And all this modern psychology and all these things that are going on, all these like that, they don't have an answer for that. That is the relation between subject and object. What creates this correspondence between subject and object? All of modern philosophy is lame in answering this. It's reduced either the subject to the object or the object to the subject. These days, mostly the subject to the object, materialism. Saying there's no such thing as the mind. Mind is an epiphenomenon, a biological phenomena, cells in the brain, and that's it. And then with those idealists who say, in fact, there's no external world like Berkeley and other people, and he even has his defenders today among certain brain specialists. Sir John Eccles, remarkable Sir John Eccles, English neurologist who won the Nobel Prize, had his book called The Mind and Its Brain to prove that the mind is not an epiphenomenon phenomenon of the brain. That the brain is an instrument which the mind uses. He brings up some of these argument. So accept this relationality is a very difficult thing. And so we take it for granted. Like, for example, I call my son-in-law, Valley. Valley, and he says, yes. What is taking place? These sound waves that come out of my mouth, their angstrom, amount of energy, can be measured. But what about the message? Why is it that he hears it and notices his own name? What takes place? We do not know. We do not know with modern science, but metaphysics is able to provide that answer. That is the answer that the correspondence that exists between various levels of reality vertically and also horizontally. The correspondence that exists between us as human beings and the whole earth. Let me give you a very simple example. Why is it we are the only creatures that can destroy the earth? All the big animals, the elephants, dinosaurs are much bigger, they're eating up all forests. Why is it this 5'8", 5'9", human being, 5'5", human being, small human compared to many other big creatures of the earth, all of which we're destroying? We are going to be left with only mice and lice very soon. Destroying all the big animals of the world, as you know what's going on. Why is it that we can destroy the earth? Nobody can provide an answer for that. Through Homo sapiens, we evolved from the apes. Why isn't the apes were not able to do this? What happened in the evolutionary process to bring about the possible destruction of the biology which created the evolutionary process? This is logically absurd. So we don't talk about it. But these are all very, very profound questions that have just scratched the surface, with which metaphysics alone, in the sense that I tried to explain to you, can deal. Now, one step further. I mentioned this already briefly. One of the greatest dangers that the world faces today is the application of a science which considers the world to be independent of God, of any spiritual reality. That is modern science. Don't be fooled by the fact that some modern scientists believe in God. That's a private matter. As I mentioned, the God hypothesis and stuff for a lot is irrelevant to quantum mechanics and to relativity and to modern physics or even to classical physics of Newton. It's simply irrelevant. You want to believe, fine. You don't want to believe, fine. Nothing to do with this. Your PhD does not depend on whether you believe in God or not, or whether you become a professor and later on the same way. So it's a science which has declared its independence from the divine reality. In the name of freedom of thought, it declared its independence from religion, and also declared its independence from metaphysics. In the 17th century, as Burt showed in his classical book, The Metaphysical Foundation of Modern Science, there was still an attempt to find a metaphysical foundation. Leibniz, Newton were interested in this. But it was given up very quickly. And we live in the most anti-metaphysical age of human history in the West, where metaphysics in the Vienna school, which led to the logical positivism of what dominates Soviet America today, they talked about metaphysics about like cobwebs. And there's a cobweb left from an earlier age to be removed. I believe in a very, very anti-metaphysical age. And that is why you have this phenomena that comes through the back door with New Age. They come out of these metaphysical bookshops called, all of which deal with New Age phenomena and look at the nature. And that was just pseudo-metaphysics. That was not really serious metaphysics. But it showed the need, the deep need for another kind of knowledge. But the efficient knowledge that dominates over Western society is a science which is worship practice, really God, for most people, they don't say it, even for a lot of Muslims. It's not Allah, but it's the science that is the God and its application in technology, not only for economic reasons, but for the sense of power and glory and power and so forth. Now, this science itself is one of the greatest dangers for humanity. If you were left alone just to the science department, that's fine, you can do whatever they say. But since it's applied all the time, a Muslim Persian physicist at MIT invented the laser, Professor Javan. He didn't know that years later you could kill and burn hundreds of people from the air with it. And the first time this occurred, I knew him personally. He was crying all the time in his office. He said, what a monster Frankenstein I've created. And they could give 100 examples of this. Robert Oppenheimer died of grief because he made the atomic bomb. He was a man of conscience and realized what a disaster he had brought about. We don't need too many examples of extreme examples, but much worse than the extreme examples is slow death. We're all suffering through the destruction of the environment. It's a slow death. One of the great writers about this, he said, if you put some hot water and throw a frog in it, it will jump out immediately. But if you put in cold water and then turn on the heat and slowly the water warms up, it will kill the frog and you can eat it. That's what's happening to us, that slow burner. If you were a very big burner, we would be out in the streets and stop all of these things going on. But since it's a slow death, a few people talk about it, the others go about their business. Now, there's no way to really criticize in depth the misdeeds and the limitations of modern science and technology except through traditional understanding of metaphysics. There are social critiques. Some of them are quite good. There are methodological critiques. There's a field in which I'm professionally involved. Yes, but they don't really touch the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter is, what is the nature of reality? What kind of science knowledge do we get with this particular method we're using about nature? Now, this exhausts all the reality of what we are studying. If you're studying a forest only from the point of its timber and how much you're going to sell the wood for on the market, you're missing out on the life of the birds that live in the forest, obviously, and even the insects that are living underneath the trees, obviously. That's what we're doing all the time. And it's only metaphysics that can really perform the service, and that's one of the greatest tragedies, is that there's so little of it, and those few people who make such criticisms, nobody wants to listen. Nobody wants to listen. I've been in this battle for 50 years, I can tell you from experience. Now, I have so many other things to say, but I have to conclude that I want to turn to another very important discipline, very, very crucial and central discipline. Let's call it the science of man, anthropology, but not in the modern sense. Because anthropology comes from the Greek word anthropos, meaning the human being, insan, man in the original English sense, that is male and female both, and of course logos means study, the study of anthropos. And I don't like to use anthropology because today anthropology taught in colleges doesn't deal with man. It deals with how many silk stockings women buy in London and then what relation that has to their income and this kind of thing. We have a village and study the dietary habits of the villagers, this kind of thing. But the anthropos in the spiritual sense and metaphysical sense is not discussed. I've sent several of my best students to study anthropology because they were interested and they all had to suffer through it because they could not deal with the anthropos in anthropology as anthropos. That they deal with it as either an economic animal or a social animal or something like that. They could not get into deeper issues, even cultural anthropology, not to talk about physical anthropology. But let's use it for the moment as science of man, literally anthropology. One of the most important roles of metaphysics is, of course, the creation of a traditional science of man, which also includes psychology. Psychology and anthropology. Let me start with psychology. In order to know something, you have to comprehend it. That's what comprehend means in English. In order to comprehend it, you have to embrace it. As I said yesterday, the Latin word verb comprendere means to embrace. Just like this, as if I were meeting my dear friend and I was embracing him. This is called comprehend. That we have to be muhit, as we say, to everything. You know, in Islam, Allah ala kulli shay'in muhit. God encompasses all things, which also means comprehends all things. And Muhit is one of the divine names. And the debate among theologians, but it's one of the divine names because Allah, Allah, Kul Shay Muhit. Whatever you have, God has a hata over it. That is, He encircles it, embraces it. It's in His arm, you might say. Not to use too much anthropomorphic term. Now, in order to know anything, you have to comprehend it. That means only the greater can know the lesser. We can know the nature of this wood underneath this tablecloth God is material. We belong to a high level of reality, and our mind can understand this. Now, modern psychology tries to understand psyche through the psyche of another person who's called a psychologist. This is unacceptable in Islam. Only the person who knows the spirit can treat the psyche. And so to know who we really are is a very crucial matter for psychology. And also for anthropology, more abstractly, what the science about consciousness of the human being. Now, the Quran has a full-blown anthropology, the science of who we are. First of all, we're created by God. God blew His spirit unto us. As the Quran says, from the very spirit of God. So the spirit of God is in us. And then He's endowed us with all the different powers. Put aside all the descriptions the Quran gives of the stages of the incubation of the child and the womb of the mother and so on. I'm not talking about those things, they're quite incredible. But the net product, which comes out, is a being who has multi levels of reality within himself or herself, who is both free and invited by God to submit his freedom to God. The paradox of being a human. God is creator of free will, but we're called Muslims. That is, he who has surrendered himself to God. God wants us to freely submit our free will to him. So it brings out this creature who has free will, has all the different faculties. And then all the vertical faculties, which are not to be seen, emotional, mental, and spiritual. And the totality comprises the Islamic understanding of being a human being. And the Quran spends a great deal of time both talking about al-insan, that is men and women, and then men and women separately, as complementing each other. And the whole question of gender and so forth, into which I will not, has nothing to do with my talk here. But that itself, to understand, is a metaphysical issue. Why does God say He created everything as wajan in pairs? God is God. Why couldn't He just create without pairs? No? If He has infinite power, it's Allah Kulli Shay'in Qadir. Again, it's one of those questions that either you say, well, I don't know, God says so, I'm not going to ask. Or if you ask, you have to ponder about the meaning of it is. And again, comes back to the question that only God is one. Creation means separation. And separation is, first of all, complementarity. In the same way that same separation, the separation from number one, the only first separation is two, azwajan. And then come the other level, great numbers, in the same way. Now, therefore we have a science of anthropology which takes account of the whole of the human being in every way and deals with all of the vertical faculties that he has or she has, and also the differences between the genders, why such exists, Islam's insistence of the lack of equality, but of the insistence of the complementarity of male and female in this world, but equality before God. That is, the gates of heaven and earth are equally open and closed for men and women. The Quran keeps insisting. There's no discrimination from that point of view. But the social obligation and so forth, and so economic, the division of inheritance and so forth, there's a kind of division of labor, you might say. The man is responsible for all of the wealth, all of the expenses of his wife. Even if she's a millionaire, she doesn't have to spend a penny. But then he inherits twice as much as his sister does because of this responsibility that he has. As he was saying, he had his mother and aunt and daughter and so forth, daughter-in-law and so forth and so on. So it's a kind of equality created through what appears to be lack of equality, which many Muslims do not understand, and all of this modern feminism that's going on, Islamic feminism, oftentimes tries to act wiser than God. But we're not wiser than God. And to understand why this is so, again, is a metaphysical issue. It's not only a legal issue. To understand the gender, to understand the sexes, sexuality itself is a very deep metaphysical basis. It's not just a biological animal act. It's a very, very profound metaphysical basis, and the complementarity of the sexes why, in fact, the male and female attract each other. These are unbelievable mysteries of creation. Unbelievable mysteries of creation, which we either gloss by or our sages over the ages have tried to explain in much deeper ways. Now, since I want to give plenty of time for people to ask questions, I'll be quick, but I want to deal a few minutes with something very, very important, and it's a question of art. Those of you who know my writings, you know I've been concerned with the question of Islamic art for 50 years. Besides saving many of the most beautiful monuments of Iran through my own effort and running around to prevent things being destroyed, and so forth, that's one of the great tragedies of the Islamic world, is that not everything has been destroyed yet. It's a strange saying I'm giving you. In the West, everything that could be destroyed was destroyed some time ago. And what remained, they keep very well. There's no chance of Ile Saint-Louis in Paris being torn down like the House of Cairo and some monstrosity being built in its place. There's no chance of that whatsoever, or Carcassonne in southern France, or Bath in England, or other places. Whereas in our world, we see right before us the destruction of the greatest heritage every day. Every day. The Tehran that I saw, where I was born, all of its gates gone, all of the gardens gone, all of the beautiful architecture that we had, my own house, beautiful house we had, a traditional Persian house, all gone. So we live through a constant tragedy of the loss of beauty. Look what happened to Cairo. I'm not Egyptian, but when I was 12 years old, the first time I was coming to America, I spent months in Cairo. And Cairo, what they called Garden City, was a garden. Now you find 5 trees in it. The worst, ugliest buildings in the world, which the Soviet built during the time of Jamal Abdel Nasser. I just saw there'll be a few more earthquakes. Some of them fell down the last earthquake. Let the people come out and have a 10-minute earthquake to clean up the thing. This ugly, unbelievable ugliness, a city that created the Mamluk buildings, that created Al-Azhar University, that created Sayyidina Hussein, that created the Metulun. The contrast is unbelievable. So all my life, I've been involved in these matters, not only in writing as a philosopher, but I've known Hassan Fathi, I brought him to Iran, I created the first international congress ever on Islamic architecture in Isfahan, in which I invited the Queen, and I invited Hassan Fathi. I had a Chicago published book, Building for the Poor, the great masterpiece, that he wrote, unbelievable work, a man who was completely ignored in Egypt itself. Now everybody along the Nile, the rich people are trying to build the Hassan Fathi site. Alhamdulillah. So I've been practically involved with the repair of the Shalimar Gardens, speaking to the president of Pakistan. It was none of my damn business, astaghfirullah, but I also felt the responsibility for the beauty of art in the Islamic world. I'm always so deeply touched by it. First of all, I'm a person who loves classical music. I was brought up in the most classical form of Persian music. People like that were my father's cousin. I was brought up in a very rich artistic tradition. And it's always been with me. And I cannot not talk about it. You cannot talk about metaphysics without talking about art. Remember I said that in Islam, metaphysics came percolated to the rest of society through poetry. But it's not only through poetry. Every traditional work of architecture in the Islamic world is an application of metaphysical principles. Going back to cosmology, I was going to say a lot about cosmology today. I decided not to do so because it's a complicated matter and needs some science. But let me just add here that the word cosmology, which means the knowledge of the cosmos, and cosmos in Greek means both order and beauty. Very interesting. Both order and beauty, cosmos, has two different meanings, complete different meanings. One is modern cosmology, which is the extrapolation of earthly physics to the rest of the cosmos. It is the laws that we discover in laboratories, we extend to ad infinitum, and we say this is cosmology. But every 10 years it changes. Once we have Big Bang theory, then accordion theory, then string theory. I don't even bother to read about it anymore. Once I gave a lecture a few years ago in Seattle to the American Academy of Advanced Science on what is traditional cosmology in contrast to modern cosmology. I was telling them the world's most famous cosmologists in modern sense were there. It's the American Academy of Science. But they want to hear what other cosmology. Cosmology, from my point of view, not only my point of view, traditional cosmology, is the application of metaphysics to the realm of relativity, to the cosmos. That is, to know the cosmos in light of metaphysics. Many of you know a book which I wrote 50 years ago, but more than that, it was published 50 years ago at the Harvard University Press, Introduction to Islamic Cosmology, which unfortunately nothing has succeeded, superseded, I wish it had. It's still in print, it's still the only book on Islamic cosmology that people read after 50 years. It's so unfortunate. It should have been 10 books better than mine, others should have written. I tried to bring back to light what real cosmology is, Islamic cosmology, and I've written a lot on the subject since I also have a scientific background on something about physics and mathematics, both modern and Islamic, both. So I've written a lot on the subject, and I didn't want to get into it because it's a technical field, but you should at least bring back from these lectures this memory that traditional cosmology is a science of the relative in light of the absolute, if I can call it that. It's an application of metaphysical principles, the domain of relativity. And it depicts the cosmos as an icon. When you look at an icon of Christ or of Krishna in Hinduism, it's a painting, but it speaks to beyond itself. And that's what cosmology is. It's like sacred art. It's like sacred painting. They go very, very much together. But I want to mention that these principles of cosmology, which deal with how the cosmos really works in light of spiritual principles, not only the physical aspects, traditional cosmology is inseparable from all of the arts. And through that, the metaphysical principles reach the arts. As I said, every traditional Islamic building, especially architecture, all the way from Sultan Hassan Mosque and Ibn Tulun in Cairo, to Sultan Ahmed in Istanbul, to Qaraween in Fez, to Qayrawan in Tunis, to the remarkable mosque in my own country, the Jami Mosque of Isfahan, to the Badshahi Mosque of Lahore. I'm just going across the Islamic world, all the way to India, to the famous mosque in Delhi, one of the greatest masters of Islamic art in Delhi itself. All of these are really metaphysics in stone or brick. They are based on symbolism. They're based on taking us to reality beyond ourselves, to providing a space in which the divine word reverberates. And the space of the mosque is defined by the reverberation of the divine word. What could be more metaphysical than that? Don't think about the ugly building we're building right now called mosques. I don't mean that. I'm talking about traditional Islamic mosques. In the same way, we have one of the most polluted, among the most polluted cities in the world. We also are catching up with the Europeans and creating some of the ugliest places of worship of the last century. God really help us. Because Islam is based on beauty. There was no ugly mosque before the 20th century. From the mud huts in Black Africa, which are extremely beautiful, in Mali, places like that of their own, they look physically different from the Badshahi Mosque of Lahore or the Shah Mosque of Isfahan or Jami Mosque, something like that, but they all are based on the same principle. All the way from there to the ornate faience tiled mosque of Iran and Afghanistan, Central Asia, everywhere. All our architecture was beautiful. And the vernacular architecture, the houses, the inner gardens and so forth, but all application of the metaphysics that was involved in the building of mosques. The late Titus Burckhardt, God bless his soul, Ibrahim Burckhardt, had to wait for a Westerner to brought out all these principles in a remarkable book, The Art of Islam, which everyone should read, actually. Every young Muslim who's interested in his or her civilization, read that book, The Art of Islam, which explains these metaphysical principles, the symbolism that is involved. We cannot understand symbolism without understanding metaphysics, because symbolism means levels of reality. It means a reflection of a higher level of reality in the lower. Why do the Christians kiss the cross? Not because there's two pieces of metal or wood stuck together, but it symbolizes Christ. And Christ is not that wood. He belongs to a higher order of reality. So every symbol is that The West has lost most of its symbolism. Traditional civilizations lived in such a world in which everything was symbolic. Everything was symbolic. And so the art was always combined with symbolism, and the symbolism can only be understood metaphysically. It's metaphysics is the key to symbolism. It's not accidental that as soon as metaphysics disappeared from the West, symbolic art disappeared from the West. Don't say, oh, what about the symbolists in France, Verlaine and Baudelaire and people like that. They were called symbolists. They were trying to revive symbolism without having any knowledge of the metaphysical foundations. The attempt to revive, real attempt to revive symbolism in the West occurred in the 20th century in the hands of Eric Gill and such a number of Catholic artists who were devoted completely to Oriental metaphysics, who were friends of Ananda Kumaraswamy, who were reading the Upanishads and the Quran and things like that. They were Catholics. It began from them, and then went to the United States to the Catholic School of Art in Rhode Island, and for a while you had the revival of calligraphy and sacred art of Christianity and symbolism. All the interest in symbolism, one of the positive things in scholarship the last 50 years, about the works of Eliade, and they all come actually from traditional writers who first wrote about symbolism. The book of René Guénon, was a Muslim metaphysician who was a Frenchman, unbelievable books on symbolism. The Symbolique de la Croix, the symbol of the cross, which is out also in English, dedicated to one of the great Sufi sheikhs of Egypt, Sheikh Ali Ash al-Kabir, and other works like that brought to Europe an awareness of symbolism among some people at least. But in our traditional civilization, this was central. Now, when you come to a civilization like Islam, developing schools of thought like the modern so-called puritanical reformist movements, for whom the word symbolism in anything, there's nothing symbolic. Everything is literal. There's the death of Islamic art, right there and then. The beautiful mosque built along the Corniche of Jeddah were not built by Saudi architects, but by one of the students of Hassan Fathi, who was also one of my students, who lived in this world of Islamic symbolism, who tried to resuscitate that. The Qiblatayn Mosque, the Markham Mosque, were all built by him. And one or two others, also the Hassan Fathi. So one of the very important applications of metaphysics is the question of symbolism and art, to bring a meaning to the understanding of art as bringing us to, back to God. That's the role of art. No one can enter into any classical, traditional Islamic mosque without thinking of God. Unfortunately, now we can enter the Kaaba, the precinct, the only thing about cell phones and a 100-story building next door. That's the destruction of Islamic art that destroyed the Sambians. That destruction of Islamic art. And finally, my last word about the most interiorizing of all arts, music. Now, don't say all music is haram. Even Ayatollah Khomeini said only the music that is lascivious and leads one to sin is haram. Otherwise, music is not haram. The most important fatwa ever given by one of the most powerful fuqaha in Islamic history of music, which permitted Persian music to be performed again on Iranian radio and television. Music is not haram. Certain music that only dissipates the soul is haram. So what Islam did was to interiorize music. It did not develop social music, except for weddings and funerals and things like that. The chanting of the Quran is the highest form of music itself. But it interiorized music. And this is seen especially in the role played by the Sufis and all classical Islamic music. All the greatest performers of Islamic music of northern India, Bismillah Khan, Ritalia Bar Khan, they all came from the Sufi families, without exception. No exception whatsoever. I know all of them personally. In Iran, all of our greatest musicians until the last generation, they belong to either Sufi families, the Sufi orders. My father used to take me to Safi Ali Shah's tomb, the great saint of the 19th century. Half the Persian musicians were sitting there. Arabic music the same. And it was Sufism that always kept Arabic music in the Islamic world. The Ottoman world, the one single Sufi order, that of Maulana Jalaluddin Rumi, the Maulavi order, is still all of classical Turkish music is the music of that order. Go to Istanbul, as soon as you turn on the radio, that's Maulavi music. But nothing else. Nothing else. The 60, 70 years of secularized Turkey has not produced one piece of traditional Islamic music. Yes, the symphony that played Beethoven, Third Symphony, Eroica, so what? The Belgians do it much better. Yeah. The English. The traditional Ottoman music is also all interiorized Sufi music, except for certain occasions which the Prophet himself allowed, like weddings, funerals, caravan music, let's say camels and things like that, or going to war when they used to beat drums and things like that. But this kind of thing that is happening to us now, unfortunately, this secularization in music, both Western and pop and all kinds of things that are coming to the Islamic world, are like exactly what has happened to Cairo and the destruction of its architecture, to Tehran. Except it's in music and not buildings. It's exactly the same phenomenon. It's the loss of the metaphysical foundation. Besides, of course, the nafs al-ammara, wanting to make money, wanting to be rich. That's among all artists all over the world. The Muslims are no more guilty than Indians or anybody else. But you can make same criticism also of Hindu artists. What I'm saying, a Muslim artist today, as a person who genuinely believes in traditional Islamic art, has written for over 50 years about it, defended on every level, from the revival of classical Persian music during the time of the Shah, to the preservation of buildings, to writing, to lecturing. I teach a course at George Washington University on Islamic art and spirituality, still after 30 years. As a person like that, I can tell you this is not Islam alone. There are great Hindu writers who are just as critical of what some Hindu musicians are doing to the rags, to the classical Hindu music. And the same is true of Japan. Those who are purists of Japanese music are very, very critical. It's a global phenomenon. There's bastardization of so much of our art. I cannot use a stronger word. And what is the cure for that? It's the understanding of what is the nature of reality again, metaphysics, and the role that art plays as a complement to thought to bring metaphysics into our lives. If you were a peasant or a cook in the traditional Islamic world and were working in the field or in the kitchen, during the day, somehow you will hear some either chanting of the Quran or someone singing some music. That will bring some metaphysics into your life. There's something spiritual. It didn't have to do with how to make your ablutions. That was something separate. Or how to cook your food. You would have halal meat and so forth. Don't get these two confused. It would nourish your spirit. And it was everywhere. Everywhere Islam went. It either created or transformed the existing art into a spiritual art. The best example of it is North Indian music. India is one of the greatest civilizations of Christian music. But North Indian music owes most of its existence to Muslims. It's not accidental that its greatest, even Ravi Shankar's teacher was a Nawab of Rampur, my friend, the greatest master of North Indian music. He was a Nawab, he was a Maharaja, Muslim Maharaja of Rampur, who wrote the first textbook on North Indian music. Unbelievable. He was a student. Ravi Shankar, and then Ali Akbar Khan, Balayat Khan, Bismillah Khan, and I believe it ended by something very, very beautiful to see how profound and important metaphysics is to music. Because of my unbelievable love for music, I've spent nights until morning in India just listening to Qawwali or in Sufi centers or to even Indian music in other places. And we invited Bismillah Khan to Tehran. I went to the airport myself to fetch him, the driver and everything. He came out, and with his sons and so on, they all played together. They played the Shahnai, what's called the Shahnai, which is he considers to be the name of Abyssinia, but it's probably Shahnai, the royal nay, the royal flute, that beautiful sounding, oboe sounding instrument. And he said, I said, I'm not going to the city. He was speaking Urdu, I was speaking Persian, we could make up. I said, we have a room, you're room. He said, no. I first want to go to Mashhad for Ziyarat. Mashhad is one of the most holy city in Iran, where Ali Red, alayhi salam, the 8th Shiite Imam is buried. And many Sunnis also go. He was a Sunni. He wanted to go. So I said, all right. Even if we're in town, and I've got a ticket for him right there. And in those days in Iran, I could do anything. It's not like now. So 10 minutes, I got a ticket for him. And I'd hold the plane back. The plane was going to just tell the pilot to hold it. The plane, and before he left, yeah, those were good old days. I can't do that anymore. It's wrong. So he said, Dr. Nath, there are in life only two things for me, Saath and Namaz. All of you who know Urdu understand that. Saz means a musical instrument. Besides the name of a particular instrument in Turkish, it's a Persian word. That saz, we don't have saz itself in Persian. Saz means any musical instrument. Kamancha, tar, sitar, you name it. And of course, namaz means prayer. And really summarized in one, two words what I'm trying to express to you now. That all of this great musical art, which is one of our great heritages, so much lost to the younger people today who listen to this cacophony, this junk, from morning to night all their lives, and affects their soul, that this music was from the very beginning, always went to metaphysics. And namaz here does not only mean ordinary prayer, it means access to the divine. Access to the divine, not just obligatory prayer, you say Allah Akbar, Allah Akbar, you're, what you're thinking about, you were selling the bazaar and go back to the bazaar. That does not make a great musician at all. It's that interiorization of the prayer, the namaz, which goes with the saz. And this story should remain in your memories, of etched in your memories, as how significant in our civilization metaphysics always was, spirituality always was. Spirituality is a practical aspect of metaphysics. Metaphysics is doctrinal knowledge. I think with this I shall conclude my comments and turn to some questions that some people have sent here. These questions I shall read, and then if we have time, where's Mr. Fuzal Khan, someone who's responsible. I think he finally fled, woman. No, there he is, back there. If there's time, I will take some questions from the floor. How do we understand the hadith, Allah is closer to you than your jugular vein, in the context of metaphysics? It's what a good question. Metaphysics says that God is at the center of the circle of reality. But the center is everywhere and nowhere. The center is everywhere and nowhere. Wherever there is God. On purpose, I'm using the verb is without finishing. That is, where there's being, where there's something exists, God is present. Because the center of all existence. And the Quran brings that majestically by saying that He's closer to us than this jugular vein is this vein here in my neck. You can put your hand on it and feel your heartbeat. It's closer to us than our heartbeat. If you put it here, you don't feel your heartbeat. So it also means closer to us than our heartbeat. Also, of course, that blood which frees the brain, the blood into our brain and therefore our life. It's closer to us than life. Why? Because we exist. To exist is to exist on the circle of existence, the center of which is God. And there's no circle without a center. One of the attempts of modern man is to live what an Austrian author once wrote a beautiful book as a modern art is a circle without center. To live in a circle without center. But there's no such a thing. To say circle means to have a center. And this beautiful verse of the Quran is really an allusion to that. Second question. Assalamu alaikum, alaikum assalam. What is your advice for students who would seek to challenge Western secularism in the classroom, especially when reading the likes of Marx, Zizek, without succumbing to defensive methods of argument? In other words, how does one respond intelligently when you haven't been exposed to years of the aforementioned technical training? A frustrated humanities major at a liberal arts college. I sympathize with you very much. I'm also a liberal arts teacher at a college. But of course, in my classes, people don't have this problem. I understand. First of all, don't argue with the teacher and just keep your mouth shut until you get an A and get out of the class. That's serious. That's my advice. Don't get into an argumentative mode. Also, those of you in college dormitories and you have these bull sessions at your school where you just go to college and students getting together and discussing the subject at 2 o'clock in the morning, never allow yourself to discuss religious matters with people who are not religious. Because it will suck you in, that would suck your psyche into a kind of sliding slope that everything keeps going down and you're suddenly in a state of doubt and you don't know where you stand and so forth and so on. And Ghazali already made this advice in the Mongolman of Dalal. It's not that you should never argue, because how long you're forced to argue? If you're in class, somebody asks you, what did Marx say? You have to know. Well, so what? A lot of people said things opposite to Marx. But what you need to do is to have a certain amount of self-assurance. It is that which is lacking among many of our students. Seeing that those people in class belong to civilization which has nuclear bombs and goes to the moon, and we belong to civilization who has not gone to the moon and doesn't have nuclear bombs, it's the sense of power creates an inferiority complex in many, many students. That's the problem. That's the problem. The first day I was strong enough at the age of 19 to stand up to my teachers at MIT, who are the world's greatest scientists, and challenge modern physics. That was one of the most difficult days of my life. But had I not done that, I would not be sitting here before you as who I am. You need to be strong enough morally to be able, if your point of view is attacked, to defend yourself, not in a defensive way, in an offensive way. That's saying that لَكُمْ دِينَكُمْ وَلِيَدِينَ in the Quran says, to your religion, to me, mine. It's in the Quran. It belongs to the Meccan period. It's a Meccan surah. لَكُمْ دِينَكُمْ وَلِيَدِينَ. And say this inwardly to yourself. And say outwardly, this is your own belief. You keep your belief to yourself, I keep my belief to myself. This is different from the teacher arguing that you do not understand what Marx said on page 372 of the Das Kapital. That the teacher would be right. And now I'm speaking as a person who's taught for 50 years in universities all over the world. That I would expect of my students. But don't take everything you read as being the truth. The Western humanities are there to relativize everything. The way even philosophy is taught. You end up at by the fourth year, every year annulifying the year before. This philosopher said that, this philosopher said that's the opposite of it, the opposite of that. Whereas I've said years of traditional Islamic philosophy, they build on each other, not nullify each other. So the end of this is the process. Now, if you have to study the humanities, these are not traditional humanities. Try to learn some history, some English or other languages, some literature. And if you have to take a course on philosophy, it's good to know something about Western philosophy. But it's like saying, learning something about Toronto traffic. It's nothing to brag about and emulate in other cities of the world. Obviously, I'm not trying to criticize Toronto. Tehran is even worse. All the cities that begin with T these days seem to have this job. But you should not be in a state of sort of defense, passive defensiveness. Have the certitude that God is on your side. You have to go through this trial and try to do your best, say some prayers inside, and this verse of the Quran continue to repeat to yourself. Third question, metaphysically, how does one come to understand that which we perceive as not beautiful? For example, the ugliness of injustice, while recognizing that everything perceived is a manifestation of Allah's attributes. This is another way of posing the question, why is there evil in the world? That is to say, why is there ugliness of the world? Is everything is created by God, and God is beautiful. Why did He create ugly things? Now, it's a very important question, but this is not really the place for me to answer this very complicated question. Let me just summarize it for you. As I said yesterday, in Arabic or Persian or other Islamic languages, the word for beauty and goodness is the same. So to say, is God beautiful and created ugly things is the same thing as saying, why was God good and created evil? Oh. And qabih in Arabic means both ugly and evil, bad. So the two go together in our mind, in our civilization. They didn't have to separate each other. Now, there are many answers that have been given to this. Islam rejects the idea that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Is metaphysically absurd. Beauty is an ontological aspect of anything, like the weight of something. Except its perception is allowed to be subjectively appraised, because God, through His infinite mercy, has created infinite forms of beauty and has given us the capacity to appreciate certain forms of beauty and not others. There are many people in this room who appreciate very much beautiful music. Some don't. Some appreciate beautiful painting. Some appreciate neither. They appreciate beautiful scene of nature. Some, none of the three, they appreciate a beautiful human face, and so forth and so on. And this diversity of God's creation, through His mercy, He has allowed us to develop certain forms of creation of beauty. So what appears beautiful to someone may not appear beautiful to another. It's one argument is given. It's a question of appreciation, not that beauty is not there. Beauty is an objective reality. Secondly, even taking the diverse capacities that human people beings have, let me pose this question to you. Here we are in Canada, one of the naturally most gifted countries in the world. They're doing a fast job of destroying its environment, but they haven't succeeded. Such a vast country, full of beautiful forests and mountains. As soon as you get out of Toronto, everything is beautiful until you get to the next city. And this is true of every city, not only Canada. I'm just giving this example. There's overwhelming beauty in God's creation. I mean, can you think of something ugly? So, a snake, for example. That's because you're afraid of it, but snakes are beautiful. That's why you pay $400 to buy the skin and put it on your shoes. You very ladies are afraid of snakes. there's beauty. Spider, incredible beauty. Usually termites and so forth don't show their beauty to us because they're too small. I mean, don't think about it. Now that we have microscopes and see the remarkable structures that they have, so even they are included. But everything that our eye can perceive, from Mount Everest to a butterfly, is beautiful. There's no ugliness except what we create. That's our specialty. All the ugliness on earth is the creation of human beings. And that comes back to the subject that God has given us the freedom to reject them. Because He loves us. No love has meaning unless it's based on free will. If you coerce a woman to love you, what kind of love is that? Good for nothing. Or a man, doesn't make any difference. To say that Ahbabtu an Uraf, God loved to be known, and therefore He loved His creation, means that He had to give us the free will to love Him. And this is a very, very important issue. And therefore, this free will we have also been allowed to squander, to waste. Traditional man, because he still loved God, created predominantly beautiful things. The creation of ugliness was left for modern man. Understand what I'm saying is a very powerful and strong word that I'm saying to you, but look at it. Look at it. Go to an American Indian village. Everything is beautiful. They might be poor. And not the modernized things they brought from Calgary, but the traditional things, the teepees, their little mats, their pottery. Why is there no ugly, something look like something like this in the tent? Why is there so much that we create is ugly? I mean, and we know it. It's always useful. But the separation of usefulness, utility from beauty was the invention of modern man. And so much the better to realize it. So, yes, we cannot stop accepting that beauty is one of the attributes of God, as is justice. But in the same way that there's injustice in the world because of the separation of the world from God, which I mentioned, so is there what appears to us as ugliness. But in the same way that injustice is only humanly possible, you cannot say that elephants are unjust in tearing down trees and eating them or something like that. In the same way that injustice is a human trait, it's unbelievable that ugliness is also our invention in a sense. And it's one of the best proofs for the existence of God is the overwhelming beauty of His creation. All these people who are nature worshippers who consider themselves to be atheists in Canada and the United States, the phenomenon, especially at the Western world, I'm going to talk about it in my public lecture tomorrow, all of these people are not really against religion or divinity. They're finding God in the beauty of nature because they couldn't find in the church where they were supposed to go for whatever reason. I'm not getting into that. But the presence of beauty in nature is something overwhelming. And 50 years ago, we had no notion what was in the oceans. And now all of you have seen coral reefs. Incredibly beautiful combination of hues, colors, that was saved for this age of humanity when we lost so much beauty. Our ancestors never saw it. But look how beautiful it is. How little ugliness there is in God's creation. There's none really. Everything is beautiful. So, yes, to answer your question, we perceive as not things not beautiful, because we create things in the forgetfulness of God. All traditional art was created with the remembrance of God. And that's why there's no ugly traditional art. There's no ugly vase of 1,000 years ago. And these are truths. You cannot deny this. You cannot deny this. And so my time is up. 5 minutes per second from my time. I began late, so I didn't want to shortchange you. I'm ending also 5 minutes later. May God always be with you. May the blessing of the prophet always be with you. And seek knowledge unto the grave, but a knowledge that will transform you and will wound your soul and make you a better human being, inshallah. Salam alaikum.